It's Begler's World. For the next hour. And I'm Jim Begler. Going to be reading all kinds of kids' magazines. I got some Science News Explorers. Maybe a little National Geographic. See if they got some Ranger Rick. I don't know. Maybe not. Let's start with some news. Let's start with some Dogo news. Bum, 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 bum. November's Beaver Moon will be this year's last supermoon. That's really sad if you think about it. Kavi Dalazia wrote this article. Full moons are always a stunning sight, but the one on November 15th, 2024, wait a minute, that's already done. It promises to be even more spectacular. I don't know, I'll read the rest of this. Maybe it'll be interesting. It'll be the last of four consecutive supermoons following August's Blue Moon, September's Harvest Moon, and October's Hunter Moon. After this, the next supermoon will not occur until October of 2025. Yikes. Supermoons can be as much as 14% larger and 30% brighter than the average moon. They occur when the full moon coincides with the lunar perigee. I think it's perigee. Maybe it's perigee. The moon's closest point to the Earth's orbit. On November 15th, the moon was about 224,853 miles from Earth. This is a few thousand miles farther than the November 2016 supermoon, but that was the closest one seen in recent history. However, it will still be breathtaking. Well, it was. The distance between the moon and the Earth varies due to the moon's elliptical orbit. This alternately brings our satellite closer to and farther from our planet. The farthest point of orbit is known as the apogee. In contrast, the perigee, the moon's distance from the Earth, is on average 226,000 miles. The November full moon is often called the Beaver Moon, according to the Old Farmer's Almanac. This name refers to the time of year that beavers take shelter in their lodges for the long winter ahead. During North America's fur trade era, it was also the season to trap the animals for their thick, winter-ready coats. Other names for the November moon, full moon, include the frost moon, the freezing moon, and the digging moon. They don't explain those. Some people believe that a supermoon's proximity to the Earth can cause earthquakes or tidal waves. However, scientists have found no evidence to support this claim. Instead, they encourage taking advantage of the rare opportunity to capture stunning photographs of the event and to reflect on how fortunate we are to call this beautiful planet home. We call it home. Let's see, I'm going to do some more of these Dogo news. How about this? About emperor penguins spotted on Western Australian shores for the first time. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. On November 1st, 2024, Aaron Fowler, that's a good name for a guy like this, and his friends, they were at Ocean Beach, just south of Denmark, in Western Australia, when they saw an emperor penguin walking toward them. This aquatic, flightless bird had swum over 2,000 miles from its usual habitat in the icy waters off the Antarctic coast. It was the first recorded sighting of an emperor penguin in Australia. Who is this? Fowler told ABC, "It stood up in the waves and just waddled straight up to us. An emperor penguin. He was probably about a meter high. He was not shy at all. He tried to do like a slide on his belly, thinking it was snow, I guess, and just face planted in the sand and stood up and shook all the sand off." Fowler alerted local wildlife authorities, who quickly arrived to rescue the lost bird. The male penguin, nicknamed Gus, was severely malnourished. He weighed just 51 pounds, about half the weight of a healthy emperor penguin in the wild. Experts estimate that Gus is about a year old. The young bird is now under the care of Carol Biddulph, a local seabird expert. To help him cope with Australia's warmer climate, Biddulph regularly mists him with freezing water. While she is working hard to rehabilitate Gus, experts are unsure when he will be ready to return to the wild. Dr. Belinda Cannell, an ecologist at the University of Western Australia who is helping with Gus's rehabilitation, has never seen an emperor penguin this far north. And she says, "The tracked ones have never reached this far. The furthest north they go from Antarctica is about 50 degrees south latitude from my readings, and Ocean Beach is 35 degrees south, so a lot further north than what they've ever tracked emperor penguins from Antarctica before. The expert is also uncertain why the penguin swam over 2,000 miles. She speculates he may have followed an ocean current. What they tend to do is follow certain currents where they're going to find lots of different types of food. So maybe those currents have just tended to be a little bit further north towards Australia than they normally would be, she said. Regardless of the reason for his epic swim, Bidulph is thrilled that Gus is here. Never in my wildest thoughts would I've ever thought that an emperor penguin, that I'd have an emperor penguin to care for. It's just such a privilege to be part of this bird's journey, she said. Emperor penguins are the tallest and heaviest of all living penguin species. They're usually found on the sea ice surrounding Antarctica's coast. Experts estimate that there are about 595,000 emperor penguins left in the wild. However, exact numbers have been hard to confirm. The 66 known colonies are scattered in remote, hard-to-reach areas. In 2022, these penguins were added to the endangered species list due to threats from sea ice loss driven by climate change. Next article here. On Bigler's World, singing with Dogo. They got some good articles. Amateur paleontologist finds an almost complete titanosaur skeleton. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. About 2 years ago, Damien Bochetto was walking his dog in a forest near Creusy. Is that a place? In southern France, Creusy, when he noticed a large bone poking out of an eroded cliff. Suspecting it might belong to a dinosaur, the amateur paleontologist quickly alerted experts at the Creusy Museum. His hunch was correct. The fossil turned out to be the pelvic bone of a titanosaur, one of the largest dinosaurs ever to roam Earth. The site excavation, which ended in March of 2024, uncovered much more than a single hip bone. The paleontologists unearthed nearly 70% of the ancient giant's skeleton, with the bones from the back of its head to its tail still connected. Only the femur and skull are missing, but scientists hope to find them in future digs. Titanosaur fossils are relatively common in Europe. However, it is rare to find an almost complete specimen. The researchers suspect that the 32.8-foot-long dinosaur was buried shortly after it died. This stopped its body from completely decomposing, leaving some tissue connecting the bones. Let's see, who is this? Bochetto, who worked with the archaeologist team to unearth the fossil, said, "This is a rare and exceptional discovery in France and Europe. On the day that we saw it, it was almost completely connected dinosaur. The excitement was at its highest." Tyrannosaurs are a group of massive, long-necked herbivores, that is, dinosaurs, from the sauropod family. They roamed Earth about 150 to 66 million years ago. Some species of titanosaurs, such as, if you can pronounce this, Argentinosaurus and Patagochian, are believed to be the largest land animals that ever lived. These ancient giants reached lengths of up to 100 feet and weighed as much as 200,000 pounds. There are around 40 species of titanosaur. The scientists are still trying to identify the species of the new discovered specimen. They have also yet to determine the dinosaur's age at the time of its death. Once their investigation is complete, the fossil will be displayed at the Creusy Museum. So you can cruise on down to the Creusy. Let's see, what do we got here? Let's do some origins of some beloved Thanksgiving traditions in Dogo News. Kavi Dolazia wrote this. Thanksgiving, celebrated annually on the fourth Thursday of November, is one of the most anticipated holidays in the United States. The tradition dates back to a harvest feast shared by early European settlers and Native Americans way back in 1621. The holiday, which will be observed on November 28th this year, is centered around delicious food and various fun traditions. Here's a brief history of how some of these customs began. You got your turkey and cranberry sauce. The inaugural feast is thought to have featured geese. However, today's Thanksgiving dinners are centered around turkey. Some historians believe turkeys were chosen because they were cheaper and easier to raise than geese or chickens. The idea of pairing the bird with cranberry sauce is believed to be the brainchild of General Ulysses S. Grant.
I did not know that.
The Civil War Union leader ordered the condiment to be served to soldiers as part of their holiday meal back in 1864. Turkey trots. Many Americans start Thanksgiving morning by participating in fun runs known as turkey trots. The first turkey trot was started in 1896 by six friends in Buffalo, New York. Now it's in its 128th year. It is North America's oldest consecutive foot race. The five-mile event draws over 14,000 runners each year and also serves as a fundraiser. And you got your Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. There's Ronald McDonald floating above the crowd. The first Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was held in 1924 to celebrate the opening of the company's new store in New York City. It was initially intended as a one-time event. However, the parade was so popular that Macy's made it an annual tradition. This popular event now tracks over 3.5 million spectators in person and more than 50 million television viewers worldwide. And then there's football. Thanksgiving football games were started by the American Intercollegiate Football Association, or the IFA, in 1876 to draw attention to college football. The Detroit Lions of the National Football League adopted the tradition in 1934 to attract more local fans to live games. Their first match against the Chicago Bears sold out 2 weeks in advance. Since then, the Lions have played every Thanksgiving except during World War II. The Dallas Cowboys joined the tradition in 1966, and the two games have since become a beloved holiday ritual. And then it says at the bottom,
Happy Thanksgiving.
In multicolored letters. Okay, we're going to do one more article from Dogo News. Bomb, bomb, bomb. This ingenious drone recharges on the go. John Wu wrote this article. Drones have come a long way since the first unsteerable model that barely lifted 2 feet off the ground was unveiled back in 1907. Modern quadricopters can now soar to high altitudes and perform a wide range of tasks. However, their capabilities are often hindered by limited battery life. To overcome this limitation, Professor Imad Abid and his team at the University of Southern Denmark have developed an innovative technology. It enables drones to autonomously recharge their batteries directly from power lines. that has disaster written all over it. When the drone's battery runs low, an internal computer uses radar sensors and cameras to locate the nearest power line. The drone then flies beneath it and attaches itself using a specially designed gripper. Once securely connected, the magnetic circuit inside activates, allowing the drone to draw power from the line. This process is similar to how wireless chargers power smartphones. Once recharged, the drone can resume its tasks. The drone, unveiled in March of 2024 at the IEEE International Conference on Robotics and Automation, is still in the prototype stage. However, the 9.5-pound version successfully recharged itself 5 times, staying airborne for over 2 hours. Professor Abid believes that once fully developed, these drones could be used for a wide range of tasks. He's especially enthusiastic about using them for power line inspections and maintenance. This process currently relies on helicopters and ground crews, which is inefficient and costly. These advanced drones would make the task faster, cheaper, and safer. Okay, let's go to another publication here. On Bigler's World. Let's do a little Time for Kids. That's right, it's Time Magazine for Kids. What is this? I think they got a bunch of book reviews in here. Yeah, it is. Princess in Peril. One of their Time for Kid reporters. This one, Evelyn Peng, wrote this. Right here. TFK Kid reporter Evelyn Peng read The Pumpkin Princess and the Forever Knight and interviewed the book's author, Stephen Banbury, read Evelyn's thoughts below. I will. That's what I'm here to do. The Pumpkin Princess and the Forever Knight is Stephen Banbury's adult novel. It's about a young orphaned girl named Evelyn. One Halloween, she escapes from the orphanage and is found by the legendary Pumpkin King. The Pumpkin King takes her in and dubs her the Pumpkin Princess. Evelyn must learn to live with supernatural creatures such as witches and werewolves, and she realizes that not everyone appreciates a regular human girl in their midst. Just when she starts to feel comfortable, an evil plot threatens her and her newfound family. To what lengths will Evelyn go to protect her home, you may ask? Banbury says readers might connect with the book in different ways. Some people who are having new experiences will relate to Evelyn feeling like a fish out of water. It's him talking here. A fish out of water, making friends for the first time. Parents can also relate, perhaps connecting with the Pumpkin King becoming a father for the first time. The Pumpkin Princess and Forever Knight is a heartwarming novel, perfect for readers of all ages at all times of the year. Okay, what else have they got here? Is this another book? Friends in the Wilderness. This article by Time for Kid Kid reporter Safiya Hussein. What is this about? Safiya Hussein read Off the Map and interviewed Makia Hashimoto is the author. Read Safiya's thoughts below. I'm going to do that right now. In her latest novel, Off the Map, Mika Hashimoto. She takes readers on a gripping adventure in Alaska. Marlo sets out on a canoe trip, and she takes every year with her mother and her dog. But this year, to Marlo's surprise, her mom has invited Marlo's ex-best friend, Amos, and his father. Before long, Marlo and Amos find themselves separated from their parents, at each other's throats, facing life and death challenges in unfamiliar territory. With only each other and some supplies, Amos and Marlo must learn to set aside their differences as they work together to survive in the wilderness. Can they do it? A nature lover, Hashimoto knew she wanted to set her story in the Alaskan wilderness, which she had visited prior to writing Off the Map. And she says, "It is breathtaking. It is huge. It is a place where if you get lost, you really, really can get lost." Marlo and Amos's time in the wild is packed with thrills, but Hashimoto's favorite parts of the book are the quieter moments, the conversations between Marlo and Amos about their relationship and what went wrong. She particularly enjoys when they talk it through and each realizes where the other is coming from. Off the Map is a perfect combination of adventure, peril, and heartfelt moments. Hashimoto hopes the story will encourage readers to expand their love for nature and dive into experiencing the outdoors just like Marlo and Amos do. Marlo and Amos. Okay, what is this? Movies and television. Time Off. The Inside Story. This article by Time for Kid Kid reporter Disha Rai. Based on the novel of the same name, the new movie, Out of My Mind, is about Melody Brooks, a sixth grader with cerebral palsy. This affects her speech and movement, so she isn't given the same opportunities as her classmates. A teacher sees Melody's potential and moves her into mainstream classes. Melody is excited to show everyone what she can do. Let's see, Phoebe Ray Taylor, 15, plays Melody. As a person with cerebral palsy, she says she relates to her character's struggle. She says, "Melody is put into this box because of her disability," Phoebe Ray told Time for Kids. "She finds a way out of that and gets other people to see her, not her disability, but her intelligence and her personality." Out of My Mind is now out on Disney Plus. Disney Plus. What do we got here? This is the movie. I know all about this a little bit. Actually, just not that much, maybe just a little bit. Magical Moments, the name of this article by Time for Kid Kid reporter Vivian Goldhirsch. Wicked, now in movie theaters, imagines what happened before Dorothy fell into the land of Oz. Based on the hit Broadway musical, the movie stars Cynthia Erivo, and Ariana Grande, as witches Elphaba and Glinda. Marissa Bode plays Nessa Rose, that is Elphaba's sister. Like her character, Nessa, Bode uses a wheelchair. She's the first actress with a disability to play the part. Bode started acting when she was 8. She began using a wheelchair at 11 after a car accident. It definitely has given me a lot more understanding and empathy of humans in general, she says. With Nessa, I relate to her in many ways, particularly her wanting to find a sense of community. Wicked is about celebrating people's differences. The theme is meaningful to Bode, who says being cast in the movie was a dream come true. Her favorite moment on the set? Flying. I loved being in the air, Bode says. Being on wires isn't something I do every single day, so that was a lot of fun, and that felt very magical to me. And we got one more thing. No, a couple more things, maybe. Undead Adventure. Bum, 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 bum. What is this? Written by Time for Kid, Kid reporter Mayor Ballas. It says here, reporter Mayor Ballas read The Last Kids on Earth, the graphic novel, and interviewed Max Brailer, its author, and commands me to read Mayer's thoughts below. I'll do it. The Last Kids on Earth, the graphic novel, is an illustrated version of the first book in Max Brailer's best-selling Last Kids on Earth series. The original book came out in 2015. Now, along with illustrator Brian Chorilla, Brailer has given graphic novel lovers an opportunity to connect with this story. The book takes place in a town called Wakefield during a zombie apocalypse. That was the place to be, apparently. It's written from the perspective of 13-year-old Jack Sullivan. Brailer told Time for Kids that he likes the end of the world as a setting because there are no rules during the apocalypse. He says, as a kid, there are always rules everywhere. If it's midnight and you want to go outside, you can't. But if the world was ending, oh, we can. Jack takes advantage of this setting and tries to make the zombie apocalypse more fun, teams up with his friend Quint and the school bully Dirk Savage. Jack's most dramatic quest is to rescue the girl he likes, June Del Toro. He believes that June needs a hero, but when he finds her hiding out in their school, she clearly doesn't need to be rescued. Instead, Jack and his crew recruit her to join them. When they attempt to leave in the morning, a giant monster, Jack calls him Blarg, is waiting for them outside. Do they make it out alive? Oh, no. Brailer said he likes to think of The Last Kids on Earth as an adventure series first, as opposed to a horror series. There's scary stuff to it. There are monsters and zombies, he said. But what I really hope for is that a big adventure story, you know, the action, the comedy, with a little bit of horror. Brailer achieved this goal. I really enjoyed the comic action. My favorite part is when Jack daydreams about June. I would recommend this book for comic book lovers who enjoy comedy, action, and monsters. And let's see, we'll do one more article from Time for Kids. Deep Sea Danger. Bum, bum, bum. Lillian Stone wrote this here. The ocean is full of amazing creatures. It's also full of plastic. There are about 171 trillion pieces of plastic floating in the sea, according to a study published in the journal PLOS ONE back in 2023. That's bad news for marine animals such as deep-diving whales. They can mistake the plastic for food and eat it. How do whales mix up plastic and prey? Well, a team at the Duke University Marine Lab in Beaufort, North Carolina, has been looking into this question. The team has just published research that explains why some deep-diving whales get confused. It all comes down to echolocation, a natural process that allows whales to hear objects in the darkest depths of the sea. Hunting by sound, not sight. Some types of whales, including sperm whales and beaked whales, hunt in the deepest parts of the ocean. There's little light at those depths, so it's too dark for the whales to see, but they can hear. To navigate their surroundings, deep-diving whales use sounds produced by echolocation. First, the whales make a sound, then they listen. They hear echoes bouncing off nearby objects. These echoes allow the whales to hunt. The echoes bounce off prey animals like squid, and they bounce off objects that are not edible, like garbage. The scientists found that the garbage and the prey cause similar echoes. To the whales, they sound the same, and that can trick the whales into eating the trash. The scientists gathered items such as bottles, bags, and rope. All of these have been found in the stomachs of whales. The team bounced sounds off these objects at frequencies similar to those that echolocating whales use. A machine measured the strength of each echo. The team then compared these echoes to those produced off the bodies of prey animals. The echoes from the plastic items were similar in strength to those returned by the prey animals. Greg Merrill, he's a marine biologist, is the lead author on the study, and he was kind of surprised by the results. We knew that they were eating the garbage, he told Time for Kids. There had to be a reason. Finding a solution. Eating garbage is dangerous for whales. The plastic can build up in their stomachs, preventing food from passing through their bodies. This can be deadly. Merrill says, plastic pollution impacts animals that are so far away from our daily lives. This problem is really big. Everyone can play a part in reducing plastic pollution. People need to make real changes in their daily lives and then advocate for the types of solutions that we need to address the issue, Merrill says. Advocacy can be as simple as writing to your mayor or governor, he says, asking your school leaders if they could make decisions that are more sustainable. Many kids are passionate about marine life. You got Freddie Slater Reynolds. He's 7 years old. He's one of them. The study makes him feel worried about the whales. He shared his advice for people who want to keep trash away from wildlife. Don't litter. Throw it in the garbage bin, he says. Above and below, beaked whales and sperm whales are deep sea hunters. They dive thousands of feet to find food, but not all whales use echolocation to hunt. Some stick closer to the surface. The humpback whale, like those in the picture here that are breaching, they're all sticking their heads up. They sometimes use a technique called lunge feeding. The whale opens its mouth wide and surges through a school of fish or krill. If you're lucky enough to witness a whale's vertical lunge, you'll see the huge animal's head rise above the surface. Okay, let's go to science news. Science news explores. Are plants intelligent? It seems to depend on how you define it. Plants communicate, learn, even remember. And that's fueling a big debate in biology. Who wrote this? Avery Elizabeth Hurt put this together. It's a pleasant summer morning. Across a field, a line of poplar trees sways in the breeze. Insects buzz and flit among the branches. Everything seems calm and peaceful. But don't be fooled, Chevy. These trees are actually under attack as hungry insects chomp on their leaves. The trees can't hide and they can't run away, but they aren't helpless. They have ways to fight back and even aid each other. As soon as an insect starts gnawing on a leaf, the tree mounts defenses. It also quickly messages its neighbors, "We're under attack. Get your defenses ready." It might even call on other insects for help. All of this happens in ways we don't see. But scientists are learning that plants can do many things we associate with thinking. Plants communicate with each other. They can learn. They form memories. They can even recognize their relatives. And they do all of this without a brain. I know what that's like. Could these abilities mean plants are intelligent? We may never fully know. As Simon Gilroy puts it,
it's very difficult to think like a vegetable.
Still, researchers are working to get to the root of what's going on when plants act in ways we thought only animals could. Talking seedlings and frightening mimosas, says Gilroy.
When you look at a tree, it looks like it's doing absolutely nothing.
Gilroy is a botanist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also one of several scientists who've been taking a close look at plant behavior. They're finding that the plants seem still and quiet, they're actually quite busy. And what are they busy doing? That's pretty amazing. In the 1980s, botanists first found signs that plants communicate with each other. In one early experiment, hurt trees seemed to warn their neighbors of danger. Back then, Jack Schultz and Ian Baldwin were young researchers at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. They potted up tree seedlings and sealed them inside a clear plastic container. Each had its own pot, and the trees didn't touch each other. When the researchers tore leaves on one tree, it responded by producing a chemical to repel attackers. Then about 36 hours later, the undamaged trees made the same chemical. The hurt tree must have sent a signal through the air to the others, the team concluded. Some people describe this as plants talking to each other. The finding, reported in 1983, launched the science of plant communication. Since then, scientists have shown this communication can be fairly complex. Plants respond better to messages from close kin than to ones from unrelated plants. It's something Rick Carban has shown at the University of California, Davis. He studies how plants and insects interact. Work by this group and others shows that plants can tell one predator from another. They send different signals depending on what type of insect is attacking. Their messages can even signal how far away danger is, a team in Finland now reports. It shared its findings September 12th in Science. And not all plant messages are intended for other plants. Some are meant to lure critters that eat whatever's feeding on the plants. When nibbled by tomato hornworms, for instance, tomato plants release chemicals that attract the hornworm's enemies, explains Schultz. He now works at the University of Houston in Texas. Plants can even use more than one language. Most studies have focused on chemical signals, but plants sometimes use sound, too. In 2023, a team in Tel Aviv, Israel, recorded clicks and pops made by plants under stress. These sounds varied across plant species and types of stress, such as drought and being cut. Although roughly as loud as human speech, they're too high-pitched for people to hear. Other animals, however, such as bats, mice, and insects, might be able to hear them, the researchers note. Okay, what have I got here? Next section. So, might other plants? That's a lot of evidence that the plants respond to sounds, says Heidi Appel. She's a plant ecologist at the University of Houston. For instance, plants can hear when insects munch on their leaves, her team has shown. Other work suggests that plants can learn and even remember. One famous study, back in 2014, used a plant called Mimosa pudica. Known for being sensitive, it curls its leaves when it's disturbed. The researchers potted up dozens of these plants, then they dropped each mimosa 60 times in a row. The plants weren't harmed by the drop. It was short with a soft landing, and they curled their leaves, but only the first few times. Pretty quickly, they stopped reacting. Just to be sure the plants weren't too tired to fold their leaves, the researchers shook the plants. Now they curled their leaves right away. But when dropped again, they didn't curl them. The plants had learned that the drop wasn't going to hurt them, the researchers concluded. A month later, they tried the experiment again. The plants still didn't curl their leaves after being dropped. It was as though they remembered that it wouldn't hurt them. They had formed long-lasting memories. No nerve cells, no problem. It shouldn't be surprising that plants can do all of these things, Gilroy says.
Everything that's alive has to solve the same problems, he notes. Plants have to feed themselves. Plants have to get water. Plants have to defend themselves.
But plants solve these problems very differently than animals do. A hungry person might chase down a deer or search out fruits. A plant's food comes from sunlight, carbon in the air, and nutrients in the soil. And a plant can't swat or avoid insects as we might. Instead, they've evolved their own ways to solve problems. Plants turn to follow the light. They deter bugs by making bitter compounds. They send roots towards water and nutrients. They even release chemicals that change the soil to make it better for the plant, says Gilroy. None of this involves a brain or a nervous system. So how do plants remember and send messages without a nervous system, you're asking yourself? The researchers who dropped the mimosa plants had an idea about that. They suggested that there may be other ways to remember. Neurons, or nerve cells, send messages via chemicals called neurotransmitters. Even though plants don't have a nervous system, they have many of the same neurotransmitters that animals have. One of those is glutamate. Wounded leaves use glutamate to send messages. These signals tell undamaged leaves to boost their defenses against possible threats, notes Edward Farmer, a plant biologist at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. He and his team published this finding back in 2013. Since then, other teams have learned more about how this messaging works, and is very similar to how neural signaling works in animals, but maybe better, Gilroy and his team show. Plants have what Gilroy calls a plumbing system. This system of tubes called xylem and phloem. That phlegm, phloem, there it is. It moves water and nutrients around the plant's body. Plants use this plumbing like a nervous system, he says. Neurotransmitters can move around in their bodies through these tubes. No nerve cells needed, says Gilroy. I forget what Gilroy sounds like. here's Gilroy. Plants have to do it better than human beings. They can't run away when something bad has happened. They have to know exactly what's going on and how to respond.
So the information processing must be really sophisticated, he says. It's just not like ours.
Does this mean that plants are intelligent? These discoveries show plants are able to do far more than meets our eyes. But does this mean that plants are intelligent? Some scientists think so, others are not so sure. The problem may trace to how we define words like thinking and intelligence. Still, this has become a big controversy among botanists. And you've got Elizabeth Van Volkenburg. She's a plant biologist at the University of Washington, that's in Seattle. She's a founding member of the Society of Plant Signaling and Behavior. Yes, there's a society for that. It had once been called the Society for Plant Neurobiology, but some scientists thought the term neurobiology was a poor fit. After all, plants don't have a nervous system. Some scientists are, she says, very, very, very against the idea of plant neurobiology. But Van Volkenburg likes the term. Technically, a plant lacks nerves. Still, it has a sensory system. What's more, she points out, in the older scientific literature, xylem and phloem, whatever, however you pronounce that, were referred to as nerves. The idea that plants can hear was a hard sell 10 years ago, Appel recalls. She's married to Jack Schultz, and even he was skeptical.
He's one of those who discovered talking plants, she says, heartily laughing.
Even now, this idea raises questions. Appel says,
we do know that plants respond to vibrations in their environment. There's no doubt about that.
However, whether plants can hear seems to depend on what you mean by that term.
If you define hearing as detecting vibrations in the environment, recognizing different kinds of vibrations and responding in an appropriate way, she says, then yes, plants can hear.
That doesn't mean that plants think about what they hear in the same way we would, though. As to whether plants are intelligent in the way we think of human intelligence, Appel says we just don't know.
These are mysteries that we're trying to understand.
Still, she urges, we need to resolve this controversy, and that means doing more science. Or maybe it's not a question we have to answer, counters Carban and Davis. Many people in this field are upset and don't like the word intelligence. I couldn't care less, he says. A lot of it is just about words. Words can be hard to define, agrees Andre Kessler. He's a chemical ecologist at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. In a paper that came out last April, he addressed what he calls the plant intelligent hypothesis. It's hard to agree on whether plants are intelligent without first agreeing on what intelligence is, he says. He and Michael Mueller, they point to one paper that found more than 70 different definitions for intelligence. It would be better, they write, to focus on what plants can do. How do they interact with other organisms, for instance? How do they respond and adapt to their environments? By such measures, Kessler says, plants should be viewed in some way as intelligent. However, if you describe it, scientists are learning that plants are far more amazing than most people realize. And to amaze us, they don't have to be like us. Take a look at the plant on your windowsill or the tree in your garden. It won't ever be able to pass your math exam, even if you whisper to it every day. It won't learn your name. But when it comes to doing what it needs to do, the things that matter to it as a plant, it's remarkable. And it does all that without a nervous system. Concludes Schultz at Houston, "You don't need to be a brain to be an elegant solution to life on Earth." Okay, next article here on Bigler's World. Sticking with science news, explorers. This is an interesting story. They have a rat with a backpack on, or it looks like a vest, I guess. Giant rat border agents could help put a stop to wildlife poaching. The rodent, rodents, plural, learn to sniff out elephant ivory and other goods from at-risk species, says Sophie Hartley, who wrote this article. A new kind of border patrol agent could soon sniff out smuggled goods in African ports. They are rats that wear tiny red vests. Like dogs, African giant pouched rats have a great sense of smell. Researchers thought the rodents might be able to detect illegal goods that are smuggled across country lines. So trainers taught them to identify items from at-risk species. The animals might be able to help protect those species by finding smuggled ones before they could be sold. Many tourists visit regions like West Africa to see wildlife, but some species are disappearing. Poachers add to this problem by catching animals for the pet trade, or they may illegally kill some for their parts. They might hack horns off living rhinos, for instance, or they might leave dead elephants to rot on a forest floor. Products like rhino horns or elephant tusks are usually taken to other countries to be sold. Poaching and smuggling are destroying biodiversity, says Isabel Zott. She's a behavioral ecologist, and she says, "It's very brutal." Scott is used to work in Tanzania, Africa, with a group called APOPO. APOPO. This group has trained African pouched rats to put their noses to use before. For example, some of these rats learned to detect dangerous weapons. Some can even sniff out lung disease called tuberculosis. People at APOPO thought the rats also had potential ports where products enter and leave the country. Besides their incredible sense of smell, these rats are agile and cost little to care for. Zott's team taught 11 rat recruits how to tell the difference between odors. The laboratory was a giant box outfitted with 10 small chambers. The researchers placed different samples in each chamber. Some were from animals that got poached, others were not. The researchers gave the rats food when they kept their nose above the target odor for 3 seconds. That pose signaled that the rat had found something. The rats learned to signal when they found scales from a pangolin, a threatened small animal. They also signaled when they sniffed rhino horn, elephant tusk, and African blackwood used in some musical instruments. Eventually, rats who completed these tests could tell the 4 cents apart from 146 other odors. Zott was part of the team that reported their results way back in October 29th in Frontiers in Conservation Science. Training the rats to detect scents in the lab is only the beginning, says Zott. She went on to get, some went on there just to get lessons in fake warehouses and even real ports. When the APOPO rats get too old to be wildlife detectives, she says, they retire. They'll just live out their days, pampered with fruits, veggies, and sun-dried fish. Okay, let's move along to another publication. Let's do some frontiers for young minds. Can we tackle the environmental crisis with education? Is the title of this by Judith van der Wering and others. They list a bunch of names there, but she's the one that's going to get credit. It is not too late to stop the environmental crisis, the article starts right here with. We are writing this article in the summer of 2024, and it is warm. In fact, on the 22nd of July, there it is, 2024, Earth experienced its warmest day since 1940. The Earth's average air temperature is increasing, a process that scientists call climate change. Climate change is a problem for many reasons. For example, it makes extreme weather events, droughts, storms, and floods more common. Extreme weather events make it more difficult for people to grow food and find safe places to live. The world is also becoming less livable due to the large-scale destruction of nature, for example, due to plastic pollution. Scientists say that we are living through an environmental crisis because the quality of Earth's environment is quickly getting worse. These are hard scientific facts, which means that they can be measured. For example, based on a long history of temperature records from around the world, researchers are sure that the world is heating up. But the facts are also hard because they expose a painful reality. The environmental crisis is caused by humans. We are using fossil fuels, such as oil and gas, so intensively that the world is warming. And we are taking up so much space by cutting down forests, for example, that we endanger the natural environments where other species live. For too long, we have failed to care for the planet as well as we should. It is not yet too late to turn things around. There is still time to limit the environmental crisis. To do so, we must change the way we live our lives, and we need to do so as soon as possible. If we take the hard facts about the environment crisis seriously, we can build a healthier planet together. Environmental education. What do you think would help you and your friends change your lives and continue to a healthier planet? This is, of course, a difficult question. There is no magic trick that instantly makes us change the way we live our lives. How can we make sure that more young people learn about the strengths and vulnerabilities of our environment? How can we empower young people to help protect the Earth? Education might help. For decades, experts have developed environmental education programs with the goal of helping people understand the natural environment and what we can do to protect it. The idea behind these programs is that young people are more likely to protect the environment when they understand what we are facing, an environmental crisis, a crisis we can still do something about if we take action together. In some environmental education programs, students receive lessons or complete assignments at school. In other programs, students go out and learn by doing things. For example, they may investigate the quality of the environment close to where they live or join an outdoor camp to learn more about nature. Many environmental education programs are developed for young people like you. Of course, your generation did not cause the environmental crisis. Still, it is important to teach the younger generations so they know how to do things better than their parents' and grandparents' generations. Also, you have more power to make a difference than you might think. Why? Well, you have a long future ahead of you. This means that how you choose to live now will make a big difference over the course of your life. What will your future diet look like? How will you travel around the world? Your lifestyle choices can even inspire older generations. Young people who engage in behaviors to protect the environment often motivate their parents to do so, too. What did we test, and how did we do it? You're asking yourself. The existence of environmental education programs seems like a very good thing, but do they really work? Do they help young people understand the environment and the effects of climate change? Do they motivate young people to do things to protect the environment? Researchers all over the world have investigated these questions. This research has produced so many different findings that it's hard to draw firm conclusions. What is missing is a big research summary that analyzes the results from all of these studies. To do so, we used a method called meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is a way to combine and summarize the results of many similar studies into one big answer. We set out by searching large online databases of scientific studies. After careful screening, we found 169 relevant studies testing the effects of environmental education on young people. we noticed some interesting things. For example, research on environmental education is truly global. The studies we found were conducted in 43 countries across 6 continents. We also found that the field of research on environmental education is quite old. The earliest study was published in 1971, probably before your parents were born. Finally, we were amazed by how many young people have taken part in research on environmental education. More than 176,000 kids participated in the studies we found, and they ranged in age from 3 to 19. This group of research participants is so big, they could easily fill 2 of the largest football stadiums in the world. So what did we learn? Well, so do environmental educations really work? The short answer is yes. Our meta-analysis shows that environmental education programs have an especially big impact on knowledge. Young people who take part in environmental education learn a lot about nature, the climate, and what they can do to protect the environment. But that was not all. No, no, no. We also found that environmental education has somewhat smaller but still meaningful effects on attitudes and intentions. It makes young people feel positive about the environment and motivated to protect it. Finally, we found that environmental education encourages environmental behavior. Young people who have taken part in environmental education are more likely to do things to protect the environment, such as recycling waste, taking shorter showers to save water, carrying a reusable water bottle, or turning off the lights when leaving the room. Note, however, that measuring behavior in research can be quite difficult. In many of the studies we found, researchers used questionnaires to ask students to report on their own behaviors. Such self-reports can be informative, but they're also tricky. People sometimes misremember their behaviors, or they may not be entirely honest. Thankfully, we also found evidence from studies in which researchers directly observed young people's behavior. For example, in one study, students who had learned about waste recycling were given wrapped sweets. The researchers then observed if the students recycled the wrappers in the correct bin. Very clever. Overall, we found that the benefits of environmental education programs can be very broad. They help young people know about, care about, and do things to protect the environment. We found these benefits across different types of environmental education programs. Regardless of whether programs involved learning in class, doing some activity in nature, or going to a camp or some combination of these things, their effectiveness was similar. What we do not know yet. There are 2 important things to remember from the field of environmental education research and from our study specifically. First, we can still limit the environmental crisis. If we manage to improve the ways in which we live our lives, we can create a healthier planet. And second, environmental education can be a powerful way to prepare young people for the future. We found that environmental education does not only help young people understand what environmental problems we face, it also encourages them to act. This is the good news. Still, some important questions remain. For example, our analysis did not show what the best way is for teachers to teach environmental education. We hope that in the future, scientists will examine which activities, for example, learning in class or going to a camp, work best for children of different age groups. There are also questions about experts that they find hard to answer, but you may have ideas about and questions that you could discuss with your friends and classmates. Do you think all young people around the world should receive environmental education? Do you think environmental education should be offered in all schools? There is no right answer. The most important thing is to learn from each other's perspectives. Okay. Let's see. I got time for maybe one more article. Let's go back to Dogo News. They just posted this here. Metal detectorists unearth ancient silver coins worth millions. I've never seen the word detectorists. Who wrote this? Alvaro Aragon. In January of 2019, Adam Staples and his friends traveled to Chew Valley, that's C-H-E-W Valley, in Somerset, England, to test a new metal detector. While exploring a farmer's field, the device found a trove of silver coins buried in the soil. Staples, an auctioneer specializing in ancient coins, immediately knew they had found something extraordinary. He was right. The group had uncovered what is now called the Chew Valley Hoard, a collection of 2,584 silver pennies dating back to the 11th century. On October 23rd of 2024, the Southwest Heritage Trust purchased the coins for $5.5 million, making it Britain's most valuable treasure find. Staples and his friends will receive half the money, each taking home about $400,000. The other half, approximately $2.8 million, will go to the owner of the land where the coins were found. The coins, which date from 1066 to 1068, are believed to have been minted at 46 different locations in England. They represent a significant turning point in England's history following the Norman conquest of 1066. This conquest marked the defeat and death of King Harold II, the last Anglo-Saxon king, at the hands of William I. Roughly half of the coins bear King Harold's image, while the other half feature William I, who ruled England until 1087. Experts think that the coins were buried for safekeeping. Let's see, who is this? Somebody said, somebody named Amal Karishish. He's a curator of archaeology at Southwest Heritage. He says this: "We know that the people of Exeter rebelled against William in 1068, and that Harold's sons, who were exiled in Ireland, came back and started mounting attacks along the River Avon down to Somerset. So it's probably against that background that they were hidden." Some of the coins are cut in half. This practice was common in ancient times to create smaller units of money. Gareth Williams, a curator at the British Museum, estimates that the Chew Valley hoard was probably worth about 500 sheep, or the annual income of a large estate. The Chew Valley hoard will tour museums across the UK, beginning with the British Museum in London in November this month, 2024. The coins will then be permanently housed at the Southwest Museum of Somerset. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.